Hello, good morning. You're very welcome to the program. Between now and nine, the unwelcome sound of silence in a Wicklow Glen, voting for Camilla in Connemara, grazing on a Galway beach, and a campaign event for the election that hasn't yet been called in Kildare. So, yes, the IFA organised a big general election set piece on Thursday for the general election that we can't say is coming, but we all know is coming. And the Taoiseach joined IFA President Francie Gorman on stage in a packed main hall at the Curragh Racecourse while he set out his stall on what it would take to win farmer support at the polls. Francie Gorman, President of the IFA, joins me in studio this morning. Very good morning to you. Thanks for coming into us.
Yeah, good morning, Philip. It's good to be here.
10 months into the job, Francie, nobody would envy you because there was an awful lot of chickens that were ignored for a very long time that have come home to roost now in what's going to be the lifetime of your presidency. What are you most worried about?
Well, I suppose the bears of it, you'd be most worried about income and the issue of regulation and the cost of doing business has come up time and time again. And look, for me, this job is about taking on each issue that comes every day you get up. It's not about looking behind. And I suppose over the course of the 4 years, if you can deal with each issue in as efficient manner as possible, you'd hope that when the 4 years are up, you'd have made a difference. And I think, to be fair, with our current Deputy President, Alice Stile, she's the first female lady elected to a senior position in the association, and the NOC we have in the council staff, I think we've made a fairly good start. But
a lot of concern in that room on Thursday about the derogation, the nitrates derogation, and the possibility of losing it. Before we get into the policy stuff there, can I ask you a personal question on water quality? You've noticed changes, haven't you, in what's happening in our rivers?
To a degree, I do. I think the one thing that struck me from a child when we were born beside the river is there seems to be a lot less of a volume of water in the rivers now, and particularly when you get through the summer. I think the wildlife around it is similar to what it was when I was growing up as a child. And I know that one of the first ASAP schemes that took place in our area, which would be a good land, well farmed area with slope and countryside down towards the river. And yet, when that programme was over, they were able to show the water quality and the wildlife around the river had shown an improvement.
Okay, in your area on that stretch of river, but that's not the picture nationally. Does that worry you?
Probably not the picture in all the rivers, but what it does show is that if investment is put into the likes of those schemes, that it can make a difference. And we've met the EPA on a number of occasions, me once, but our environmental committee led by John Murphy have met them on a number of occasions since the beginning of the year. And probably the take home message for me from those meetings and talking to the lads after they've been down was the fact that maybe we weren't quite doing the right things at the right time in the right place. And the EPA would say that some of the measures that we were doing maybe weren't going to achieve what was hoped for.
And a lot of stuff has been done, and I think everybody would have to credit the progressive farmers who have taken those measures on board. But the problem is the results aren't yet showing any uptick, any significant improvement. So that means, all likelihood, you're going to lose this derogation come January 2026.
Well, I think, number one, in terms of trying to achieve an improvement in water quality, we have the fourth best water quality, groundwater quality in Europe. There's an issue around the estuaries, but even our estuaries are still, in quality terms, way ahead of a lot of the estuaries when they're measured around Europe. And I know people go on about the derogation, but If you just look at it at face value, if we have the fourth best groundwater quality in Europe and we're one of the only countries with a derogation, is it fair to say that the derogation is the cause of it? And Chagas, okay, the science would say it's not. But
hang on a second, because here's the point where you and I could get into pantomime season a little bit too early and we could end up doing, oh, yes, it is, oh, no, it isn't. But let's just take as accepted that the Commission is saying, no, Ireland, you haven't shown us enough of an improvement, the improvement that you promised when you got the derogation 18 years ago. So I'm afraid logic suggests it has to be taken away from you.
So there's a point in that, Philip, to be fair. And And what we have to do is show that we can improve water quality. And I think that across the board, from farmer to processor, right through, that maybe we didn't take it seriously enough. And maybe the review in 2022, and we would say it was a flawed review because it didn't give us enough time, but maybe that was a wake-up call for everybody. And there's no doubt that we have a whole of industry approach now with the farm organisations, Meat Industry Ireland, Dairy Industry Ireland. We know the value of it. And the measures that have been taken on farm now, I think if they're given time, will show an improvement. But will it happen in time for the end of 2025 when the review is going to be announced? Maybe the improvements, we won't reach our dead target. But at the same time, if we're showing an incremental improvement, and that maybe the likes of the EPA can look and see at what's been see what's been done on farm level.
So what you're asking there, Francie, is for people to say, for Europe to say, that's okay, Ireland, keep on doing business the way that you're doing. But no, I can tell you that what they're telling us, you know, when we put this suggestion to them, is they say, no. 18 years ago, you promised that there wasn't going to be an impact on water quality. There has been. So now it's up to you to prove to us why we shouldn't take the derogation away from you. And when you have improved water quality, give it back to you.
No, if you take the derogation away, it's going to have a massive impact on production levels. It'll have a huge knock on effect economically, both in rural communities, at processor level. And what we're saying is that we need just a little bit extra time. I genuinely believe that the work has been done through the industry to show an improvement. And it does take time. And I think, to be fair, Philip, if you go back, particularly in the last 10 years, while water quality might have gone up and down, it has generally stayed stable. And we have good water in this country. And
actually, in fairness, what has happened is that in some places it has, in fairness, improved. But in the areas that are overlapped by really intensive agricultural production, it's gone down.
In some river catchments, not in all. And we know that where you have a group of farmers that come together in something like an ISIP scheme, And take on board the advice from your ISIP advisor, you can make a huge improvement in water quality in those rivers.
We could argue the toss on that for a long time, but let's just talk about what might happen now come January 2026 if you do end up losing it. There are many farmers who could be looking at falling off a cliff edge. So is it not a more prudent strategy for the IFA to say, let's find an off-ramp, let's go and negotiate a transition out of this derogation scheme now so that we don't fall off a cliff edge?
Well, I think that comes back to time. If you climb down it, you'll get to the bottom a lot slower than if you fall off it. And I think that's what we need. We need time to show that those measures will take effect and deliver that improvement.
Okay, but then
and
are you not like the grand old Duke of York marching them to the top of the hill?
No, I don't believe that. But I think when you get to the cliff edge, you've got to see how you can get down to the bottom in the safest possible way. And that means slowly but surely.
Okay,
and
so does that mean that you are open to looking at a plan B?
Well, we're open to seeing how we can get to a stage where we can show that what we do at farm level will deliver an improvement in water quality. And I think you're going to see over time. It's only less than 10 years ago that milk quotas went. And the advice that farmers were getting at the time was to drive on. And to be fair to the best farmers always took the best advice. And the best advice now is to try and show, in terms of water quality, to show an improvement, to take on board those measures. And I think if farmers are given time, you're going to see a transition.
Okay, but the interesting thing
there is... But that time has to be given.
That you say that, but the progressive, young, dynamic farmers that we're talking to say to us they've seen the writing on the wall and they have adjusted their businesses, to start farming as if the derogation was gone already. And they're doing that and they're viable. They're putting food on the table. They're sending their kids to college. Is that not the more prudent course of action for the IFA to encourage farmers to go down?
There is no farm over the last 15, 20, 30 years that I know that has been better off by selling less, by reducing production. And even if you look at the direction of cap funding over the course of the last 20 years since decoupling came in particular, you've seen a huge shift of money away from those farms, and they depend almost totally now on the level of production on their farms to provide a viable living. And to be fair, if I had the choice in the morning of having the stock in the field to be able to sell my cattle or sell my milk and depending on a scheme that's there for 1 year, or maybe not there the following year, I would like to have as much control of my business as I can. And that means that you keep production levels up. But look, we're not looking for an out here, Philip. It's important that every farmer listening to us here this morning understands that we have got to take on all those measures in the Chagas Better Farming for Water programme, that we listen to the likes of the EPA and that we take the advice from them. And I would have heard it time and time again about wastewater treatment plants and water treatment plants at municipal level. And there's no doubt there's an issue there, and that has to be addressed. And it would be a shame if we lost our derogation down the road because we couldn't improve water quality and that wasn't taken into account.
You took a fair swipe at Uisge Éireann, the other day. Is that something that you're entirely comfortable doing? I mean, farming is the greatest source of water pollution. Uisge Éireann is doing things that they say themselves are unacceptable. But is it a good look for farming to be saying, no, don't look at us, look at Uisge Éireann?
Well, I think the point is, and Primetime did an expose on it last week and showed the effects of an outbreak at a wastewater treatment plant. I think it's fair to point it out, but I still keep saying to our members any meeting I go to that if we focus on that totally, we're in the wrong space. When you go out to Brussels and you sit in front of DG Envy, they don't want to hear Francie Gorman talking about a wastewater treatment plant in Portlaoise.
They want to hear him talking about what farming is doing. So let's just get back to that for a second, because there is a feeling abroad as well that in making the argument for maintaining herd sizes, for keeping all of those extra cows brought onto farms since 2015, that what the IFA is doing is representing the interests of the processors and of the factories, because it's they that need the extra cows to keep the factories busy, when it's fairly well established, despite what you're saying now, that there are many farms that feel we can be viable without all of those extra cows.
I think we'll disagree on that one. There's no doubt that the processing industry needs the product, and the processing industry provide huge economic value in rural Ireland.
Mm-hmm. Are you representing their interests rather than farmers' interests?
No, I think on this we're all in it together, to be fair. And look, my view on it is that if you take that economic value out of rural Ireland, and we hear it time and time again, you should diversify into this, diversify into that. But when you ask people, what exactly will you diversify into that will provide the same security of a livelihood that, you know, commercial farming can provide for your family? No one can tell you.
I'm going to take issue with you on that, because, again, and I'm only going on what we're hearing from the farmers who speak to us. They say, do you know what? A little bit of forestry in the portfolio, maybe a little bit of solar panels here and there, maybe not just dairy, but some sheep or some dry stock animals as well. And they are, as like I say, putting food on the table and sending the kids to college.
They might be, in a lot of cases, supported by a lot of off-farm income, but in general the trend has been around the world over the last 20-30 years that if you want to stay farming you have to specialise. I mean, I'm farming at home not in a very intensive way with sucklers. We have sheep, we buy in cattle. It's probably more your traditional dry stock type of farm, and I can see with the cuts to supports that we've endured over the last 20 years that system of farming is under huge pressure. And look, if I could get an easy out, Philip, I would. Farming's a tough life. I mean, most of the people, a lot of people could be listening to this programme this morning, non-farming people, but certainly farmers under tractors, their milking parlours, looking after their stock. And it's a tough life, and it's a lonely life, and it's a hard life. And I suppose our ask, and I mentioned it the other day, is that we just want people to try and make it a little bit easier. Take on board the fact that in good faith we are doing as much as we can to improve water quality. Give us the time and see Finally, and I'll admit that maybe we took our eye off the ball, if you go back 10 years ago, took it for granted that we'd always have the derogation. That's no longer the case, and there's no doubt that there's an amount of work being done. And in fairness, I think, and you heard the Taoiseach say the other day, one of her asks was that he would put on the green jersey, chair a cabinet subcommittee, which he has agreed to do. And I think on foot of that, along with the measures that we are taking at farm level, we need to see the support, investment put into nutrient storage capacity is probably the big answer long term down the road, that we could use our nutrients at okay. the right time of the year. And look, right place, right time, right measure.
Francie Gorman, thank you very much for joining us in studio this morning. Doors open any time. Francie Gorman, president of the IFA. And so to another president, the one that is going to come after Joe Biden. Tammy Joy is an Irish-American farmer transplanted from Washington State to Ballinakilla in Littermore. She now runs an agri-tourism enterprise where you can tour the farm, dine in the produce, stay the night, take part in workshops and so on. Trasa Vranach took a trip to Connemara to meet Tammy Joy, and inevitably they ended up talking about Tuesday's election and what impact that it might have on agriculture, after Tammy explained how she came to be in Littermore in the first place.
My grandfather was actually born here in the village. He was born down at the lake here in an old cottage that his father's father had built, and that's where my grandfather was born. And unfortunately, his mother passed away when he was just shy of 2 years old. And being the youngest of several children, he ended up immigrating, like so many did, to the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we're looking out onto the Atlantic here, and it's absolutely gorgeous today. But, I mean, in fairness, it must have been sad at that time because it's next stop America.
That's exactly it. And he used to talk to me about going to the local Mass Rock and sitting there and dreaming of going to the United States, which is ultimately where he did go. So when we bought this place, there was nothing here but brambles. Like I always do wherever I live, the first thing that I start doing is going out and getting my fingers into the soil and start playing in the dirt.
So you have a polytunnel here, you have raised beds, you have natural raised beds as well, you have an awful lot of flowers. What else do you have?
Oh, lots of berries.
And you have some animals up the back there?
I do. So that is Maggie May and Manny, P-I-G, or Magnum P-I-G, and we call him Manny. He's scratching at the moment. So if we go over there, they'll come chat with us and tell you that they're starving. Which they're not. Yeah. And they're actually a grazing pig. They're called Cooney Coonies, and they're a New Zealand breed. And their snouts are upturned, literally, which helps to prevent them from going in and rototilling up the gardens. Ah. And they will come and chat.
And they come and run. They're running over to us.
Hi. Hello, my dears. So this is Manny. And that is Maggie. And if you look in their garden, you'll see that there's actually grass there. Normally, you wouldn't see that in a pig pen. It would all be rototilled under.
And tell me, are they pets?
These are Patamar.
Okay.
Yes. Now, in the States, we actually raised them for meat. So I had an agritourism business in the U.S. as well, and I raised pigs as meat pigs. Uh-huh. So they weren't this particular breed 100%. They were called an Idaho pasture pig, which was a Berkshire and a Yorkshire and a Cooney Cooney cross. And the reason for that was they grew out a lot faster than a Cooney Cooney will. And normally it takes about 5 months to grow out a pig in the United States for meat from the time you start growing it out for butchering. So, yeah, these are the two pigs.
They're just beautiful. They really are. They're the cutest pigs. Tell me about your farm in the States then. You had pigs and you grew them for meat. Yeah. Did you have Manny at the time?
Yes, I did. We had a couple different sows that we then had piglets and grew those out. And then in addition to that, we raised meat chickens. So we'd have about 200 chickens at a time that we grew out. We used a breed that was a little bit slower growing than a Cornish cross. We used Freedom Rangers, and so they were out on pasture as well. Uh-huh. The idea of keeping animals cooped up in cages or, you know, not being able to be exposed to the land was not a type of farming that I endorsed.
Well, it's a big weekend in America. Who do you think would be better for agriculture generally, Trump or Harris?
That's a difficult question. It really is, because typically the Republican Party tends to be a bit better for the agricultural industry, but I'm not sure that the Republican Party as it is at this point in time will be any better than the Democratic Party.
Do you have, if you don't mind me asking, do you have a postal vote and are you going to vote?
Yes, I do, and we did. Yes. The area that we come from is typically more of a Republican agricultural area. And that would be, I'm not a registered Republican. I would consider myself an independent, but I tend to vote more along the Republican Party lines, but I did not this time.
You have more animals here, don't you?
I do. I have sheep down at the lake at the moment, six ewes. Zwarbles, they're called. Oh. Zwarbles. And they are also a New Zealand breed.
Do you think we could go down and see the Zwarbles? Are they far away?
No, not far at all.
Great.
Anything for grain. So they're all named, of course. So we have Zoe and Chloe and Sophie. And we have Delveen and Suey. Uh-huh. And hey, girls.
And they're all paying attention. They know exactly who's coming with the grain.
Oh, hello, girls. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I'm missing one. Oh. This is a good thing that we came and looked. I'm missing one of the triplets. They're triplets. There she is. Hello, Frankie.
They look so happy. Sitting there
and
in the field.
Yeah, they do.
They do. So tell me, Tammy, with the week that's in it, do you feel hopeful generally for the state of agriculture in the States?
Well, I am I'm a glass half full kind of girl. I'm very optimistic. And I do believe that the agriculture in the United States will continue to thrive. I mean, it's based on farmers. And farmers always figure out how to feed, you know, their people. So I'm optimistic that the government will work with the farmers and come up with ways to help farmers and also help the people, because the prices of food have gone sky high in the United States. Like a red pepper over €5 would be $5 for one. And, you know, it's hard for families, and something's going to need to change. So I'm just not sure where it's going to land.
Tammy Joy chatting to Trasa Vranach. More details, tammyjoyfarm.com. Some of your texts and indeed some of your WhatsApps on 0870 32 32 32. As a farmer and IFA member, I believe we all ought to obey the 170 kilo per hectare limit. That's the reduced limit without the derogation. This derogation should never have been permitted. Ireland has dragged its feet in this issue. I remember 125,000 farmers, remember that 125,000 farmers are below that limit. It's only 7,000 farmers need to reduce stock numbers. This derogation is destroying our green image abroad. And plenty of other texts as well in support of the efforts to try and retain the derogation. Coming up after the break, a sort of a nature walk of the places where extinction is a clear and present danger.
Email countrywide at rte.ie. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
Good morning, if you are just joining us. 51551, the text number in response to the interview with Francie Gorman. Luke Casey here, young dairy, beef and tillage farmer in Waterford. We have a business relationship built with the bank that unfortunately depends heavily on farming in a nitrates derogation. Reducing stock numbers isn't an option, as output to meet borrowings is required. Acquiring extra land to reduce stocking rate has been made extremely difficult due to the change of land use to solar, to forestry and various government schemes, etc. This compounds the problem. Thank you. There is no doubt it is a thorny one indeed, Luke. And one that kind of sets the scene for our next item, because there is, as we have been discussing, a kind of a deadlock between everyone's desire to see nature restored to its former glory and the thorny question of who is going to pay for it. We all want to go to heaven. It's just nobody wants to die to have to get there. And there is little to be happy about at the UN's Biodiversity Summit in Colombia this week, where there was not much of an agreement on footing that bill for nature restoration. We're going to hear from there in a moment, but I wanted first to get a handle on what not getting this right in this country would mean. What species are we about to lose, or what species have we lost recently? Naturalist and author Declan Murphy took me to see the plants and animals that only barely still have a toehold in Ireland. It was a walk that took us to a beach in Wexford, one of the country's most celebrated beauty spots, Glendalough, and we started on the increasingly battered shoreline of the Murra, just north of Wicklow town.
This is the path, the original path going down the Murra. And I sat here in June 2023, and there was a seat there, and the path was in front of us. So the people walked in front of us there, where that shingle is. By last winter, the sea had come in underneath the seat, and now the seat is completely gone.
So to illustrate this crudely, if I step out to where your seat was,
I drop 2.5 feet. Yes. And if you come down here in an easterly gale, you'll now be standing in the sea. And you can see all beside us, this is just crumbling away.
It's really very stark, Declan. About, well over a kilometre to our north, there's massive clumps of soil and grass just falling down onto the beach. What particular plant species was it that this area was home to that you're worried about?
The spring squill. It's a small spring flowering plant. It only grows on the coast, and we're at the extreme southern end of its distribution. It also only grows in a very, very narrow patch closest to the sea. And that was okay for the last couple of hundred years. You'd get a little bit of erosion, but the plant was okay. It grows from about this extreme cliff edge in about 2 metres.
And at the present rate of erosion then, that 6 feet span that it's growing in now, do you expect that to be here in 2 winters?
No. Not at the current rate of erosion here. I think one of the saddest sights I saw was this spring. The spring squills had started, had been flowering here, and this cliff top, as we can see, had collapsed right down. And the plant was still struggling. It still flowered in here. It was
in this fallen clump.
Yes.
That is going to get washed away with the next high tide.
And even the tiniest clumps, with the seaweed amongst them, the little blue flowers were struggling to keep going, and they were doomed. Even in the face of complete defeat, they were struggling to go on, and there was no hope for them. And I found that quite moving. Today's a lovely day, but in the winter, the wind coming down here, you've got the waterfall. There's a lovely sense of unchanging wilderness, which we don't... It's hard to find that in Ireland. It almost goes back to a time when there wasn't people here, and you get a little insight of what the world looked and, more importantly, sounded like when there was no one here.
And what is the sound that we should be hearing here that we're not any longer?
Well, the ring ousel was a bird that many years ago bred fairly widespread across Ireland, and it only breeds in mountain areas with rocky slopes, cliff faces, barren isolated areas. That was where it bred, and it used to occur right across Ireland through Wicklow, Waterford, Kerry, Donegal. And from a bird that was widely distributed across the country, it's now gone down to possibly only one pair. One pair was heard this year up in Donegal. One of my friends camped here many years ago, and he had seven birds singing here. And I've had one or two birds singing here going back 20, 25 years ago, and the valley has fallen silent now. I have searched for this bird throughout Wicklow, and it is gone. It's completely gone, and it's a beautiful, distinctive, whistling song, a very melodic song, totally unlike blackbirds or song thrushes, that used to carry across from one side of this glen to the other side. They would sit up on the crags up there to our left, and there'd be another one sitting on the right, and they'd whistle across. Beautiful whistling sound, and that's a sound that's gone now, and most likely will never return.
Do you come back here with any kind of hope or expectation that you might hear it again, or are you resigned to the fact that it is gone?
I come up every year to think and to hope and to live that maybe a straggler passes through, but in my heart I know there won't be.
This is the most photographed valley in the country, I think. It's quite upsetting to think that somewhere that is so iconic in the Irish landscape has this sad story to it.
Well, especially when we know it's not habitat loss in the way that people visualise habitat loss. It's gone primarily because of climate change. Now, that bird operated and lived in a niche. Other birds didn't live up here. So when it came back in the spring, there wasn't any competition. It was able to survive in a mountain environment. There was no blackbirds, no thrushes, no competition. It had the area to itself. Now, with the slight warming of the climate, the area around us, the vegetation has grew up. It can support the other birds who, it's not as cold up here anymore, and they can survive. So we've got robins, we have wrens, we have stonechats, mm-hmm. blackbirds, song thrushes. We didn't have those 15 years ago up here. So now, when the ring ousel comes back, the niche is gone. It's occupied. The blackbirds have taken over. Because in a place like this, there's limited resources. There's limited food. So there might be only enough to support a couple of pairs of thrushes. There were no other thrushes. The ring ousel managed to survive. Now it arrives back. Every niche is occupied. We're on a beach in North Wexford, just a couple of miles south of Cahor.
But it would be unwise of us to give the name of the beach that we're on. Yes. Why?
This particular species is so sensitive to disturbance. If anybody was to go onto those sand dunes to look at it, they would actually damage the habitat so badly the plant would just be dead and just be gone. The fact that nobody knows where it's growing is probably its best protection.
So what are we hoping to find here?
We're hoping to find a plant called sea stock, which is sadly very, very rare and endangered here in Ireland.
How rare?
Well, come and have a look at these plants up here and I'll tell you how rare they actually are.
Is this it, yeah?
This is it here, this little couple of clumps of sort of greyish green, almost fuzzy leaves up on the slope okay. In front of us there. If you look,
it's
you can see
it's definitely the only one of its kind in the whole dune system that I can see anyway.
Well, not alone that. As far as we know, they're the only ones in Ireland at the moment. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I can see 6 plants here.
Why is it so vulnerable?
Now, this plant is a biennial. Do you see there's no flowers there?
Yeah.
Those plants started growing this year. They'll flower next year.
So there's no seeds this year.
No.
To grow next year. So
if that comes out.
If that goes in a winter storm, That's it.
That's it.
That's the last of its kind in this country. How should I feel about that? I'm really not sure. Because there's a part of me that says, is my life going to be any poorer in the absence of a plant that I didn't know about before today? Or is that something that is profoundly shocking that has disappeared from the landscape and is not coming back anytime soon?
I think it's a very good point that you raised. How we should feel, is it going to change our lives? Not in a direct, immediate way. If that plant isn't there next year, we may not suffer the consequences straight away. But as I said, if you look up there, that plant has a lovely flower, a lovely purpley lilac-coloured flower. There's no other flowers up there that'll do that. It produces nectar. So that is a habitat that is very little resources to passing insects, to migratory insects that are coming in. It provides a source of food to them. If that's gone, then there's no source.
There's no insects here, there's no food for the birds. So who knows what species further up the food chain.
Exactly. That's the way it all works. It's not so instantaneous that goes this year and it affects us straight away next year. We're only one creature living on this planet. That's the one point we have to remember. We shouldn't be so self-centered as to say, does it matter to me? It matters to the planet. It's the planet we've got to look at, not just ourselves. We're only one creature here.
Declan Murphy, naturalist and author of A Life in the Trees, among a number of other books. Now, listening to that is journalist Orla Dwyer, who was at the UN Global Biodiversity Summit in Colombia, but joins us now from London. Orla, good morning to you. This summit, like the more well-known climate summits, is also called a COP, Conference of the Parties. What was it hoped that this COP would achieve, and how far short of that ambition has it fallen?
Yeah, good morning, Philip. This COP had a lot of high hopes and ambition behind it. And a major aim of it was to raise essentially a lot more money to put towards protecting nature around the world. So 2 years ago at the last UN Biodiversity Summit, which was held in Canada, countries signed a pact to halt and reverse biodiversity loss by the end of this decade. And this was really significant, given that, as we just heard there, around the loss of bird and plant species in Ireland, the science shows that nature is declining at rates never before seen due to things like climate change and deforestation. And so to reverse this trend, developing countries in particular have been promised a lot more money to help them do this and to help them better protect nature and to help the planet better protect nature. But the amount of money that they've been promised has not yet been delivered. So one biodiversity fund that we heard about at the talks in Colombia has around $400 million in it at the moment. And that is a far cry off the tens of billions that developed countries are expected to pay towards this fund in the coming years. So richer countries are expected to put significantly more money to help protect biodiversity around the world than is currently being provided. And that was one of the key divisions that we heard at the talks in Cali. And NGOs and developing countries were quick to point out as well that even though more money was committed at these talks, it's still millions instead of the billions that are needed to prevent the further destruction of nature.
Indeed, so still falling billions short of its target. Orla Dwyer, thank you very much for that update. Now, while that meeting in Colombia might not have been doing what nature needs globally, Lorna Siggins has found us a story in Galway of a brilliant conservation success. A local initiative between a farmer, his Dexter cows, and Galway City Council that proves that we do actually need cattle in the landscape, in a controlled way anyway. At the end of last winter, as a pilot project, the city biodiversity officer in Galway, Paula Carney, asked LACA farmer Keith Fahey if he would allow five of his Dexter cattle to graze the meadows beside Ballyluckan Beach to see if conservation grazing would improve the plant life on the 4 acres there. On the day that Lorna visited, Keith was running a little bit late with the cattle, but Paula was there with her colleague Lisa from the city's parks department, and while they waited, they chanced upon a sparrowhawk in pursuit of prey, as Paula explains.
A sparrowhawk is hunting over the meadows, and it hasn't been recorded here in many, many years. Actually, you can hear the alarm calls coming up from the meadow pipits. So that's the meadow pipits. They're flying. See some up there? And a flock of them flew up there. So they actually had the opportunity to nest here this year. So it shows that the habitat is improving. Meadow pipits actually are on the red list, and that means they're near threatened of extinction. So actually providing a safe refuge for them really within this area is really valuable to the restoration of those populations.
So this is Bula Bo Iverado. So we're waiting for the Dexters to come back. But how successful was Iverahéin, you know, their first period here? What did you see during the summer?
So we've had an expert botanist out walking transects across the paddock, and what they're doing is that they're looking at the vegetation. So they conducted the baseline survey in 2023, and they described it as a rank grassland. What that means is very heavy grasses, and because it was only mown once a year, the grasses had been blowing over and actually smothering the flora that was trying to come up. The seed bank was there, the flowers were there, but because the grassland was so heavy, they couldn't emerge. So when we had the cows in for a few months after Christmas, I'd say they left in April, during the summer months, they observed a 40 to 60% increase in floral diversity just after a few months of grazing.
Right. So as a result of five Dexters.
That's right, yes.
You had great success in your first summer.
Absolutely, yeah. So with between them removing the thatch, which is the dead grass from previous years, and because of their small hooves, they're quite light on the ground, but they don't overly poach, but they do score the ground gently. And what that does then is creates a clean space for the seeds that are there, wildflower seeds, to emerge. So by grazing that grass down, creating these little open places, the wildflora has been able to flourish.
Paula, look at that! What's that? Paula's colleague, Senior Park Superintendent Lisa Smith, shot her arm up, pointing to the sky. What's that, Paula? What are we looking at?
It's a white-tailed sea eagle.
No. Did you organise that?
I wish I did, but no. You could not plan these things. That's absolutely amazing. That is just amazing. I haven't recorded it so near the city ever before.
Have you seen a white-tailed sea eagle in the county?
In South Galway, I have seen them. And their behaviour has changed a little bit with the buzzard, the expansion of the buzzard populations. But they were part of a reintroduction scheme a good number of years ago now with the National Parks and Wildlife Service. That is absolutely the first time. I would not have expected to see it here at all.
So while Farmer Keith Fahey is stuck in traffic, we have seen sparrowhawk, meadow pivot, and now a white-tailed
sea eagle. Yes, it's very dramatic day out in Ballylock.
And badger scat.
And badger scat as well. So it's all gone out of Ballylock, and it's a real haven for wildlife out here.
I'm just going to have to follow you around. Here's the Land Cruiser.
Sorry, lads, I made a bit of a struggle getting them on the trailer. Well, they didn't want to leave.
I got in. It's all been happening. There was a sparrowhawk up to there, then a white-tailed sea eagle flew across.
Great.
Oh, I'm quite excited here today. It's all happening.
Very so nice. We were glad you were late.
Yeah, that's good.
Very excited.
They know where they are. We're coming back in our holidays.
Here's the ramp going down. Dexters are coming out. So Keith Fahey, you're back here with five Dexters. Are they the five that were here earlier in the year?
Three of the original five are here, and there's two new ones.
You and your dad got into Dexters together, your dad Francis.
Yeah, so I took over the family farm there. We have kind of a small farm there, and we rent a bit of ground as well. We did the transfer of the farm there a couple of years ago, and so I do it on a part-time basis. I work full-time for Chagas. We buy in reared calves and finish them and send them to the factory. And then we have a few Dexters as well, as kind of like a hobby or a side interest, I suppose. So completely different than the commercial type of animal we'd be buying and finishing. So, you know, it's nice to do something in relation to the native Irish breeds.
Yeah. And had your dad always been interested in Dexters?
No, actually, Dad never had Dexters. I got the mad surge to the head to get a few of them, so... Although he does like them as well now, but he would have been more used to limousines and Charlies and the more continental types of animals, although it's mainly Angus and Hereford we have now, but there'll be traditional breeds there that finish early.
So are they sort of affectionate type animals?
Yeah, they're kind of, I suppose it's all down to handling as well and how you'd handle them. And, you know, if they see you every day, they kind of, they get that bit quieter and tamer and used to handling and stuff. So I think the fact that there was so much walking and activity and dogs and everything in around here, you know, they nothing really fazes them nothing. Anymore.
What was the names of them again that the kids called them?
Mutilda.
Mutilda.
Mutilda was one of the heifers. The calves were Dovey and Dovey. Coffee Cake.
Coffee Cake.
The mare picked that name, right. Coffee yeah. Cake. And then we had Fern and Ashley.
Come on. Come on. Come on.
Moo Tilda. I understand the excitement about the sea eagle. I saw probably the same bird on the train into Galway not that long ago. I sent a table of drinks spilling, breaking my neck to actually see it. Lorna Siggins reporting there from Ballylochan Beach. Thank you for listening this morning. That's all that we have time for. Amandine Passo, Divine is endangered. Mark McGrath's on the red list. Eileen Heron looked up, saw the comet and just shrugged. Next up, Fiona Kelly on playback. Remember, Ear to the Ground is on air on Thursday evenings at 7 p.m. Have a great weekend. We will talk to you at the same time next week.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.